Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts, and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
Good evening and welcome to the Royal Academy of Arts. My name is Amy Blewett and I am the Events and Lectures Coordinator here. I'm delighted to welcome you to tonight's event with sculptor Conrad Shawcross, who is the youngest current Royal Academician here at the RA and responsible for this year's stunning summer exhibition courtyard installation, which is titled The Dappled Light of the Sun. His recent works include Timepiece, a spectacular mechanical light sculpture at the Roundhouse in Camden, ADA Project, a robotic installation inspired by Ada Lovelace at the Vinyl Factory in 2014, and a new series of sculptures which were unveiled in Dulwich Park this April. Joining Conrad in conversation tonight is Reverend Dr. Richard Davey, who is the coordinating chaplain at Nottingham Trent University and a visiting fellow in their School of Art and Design. His PhD looked at the role of faith in the work of a group of selected contemporary artists, and he continues to write extensively on artists including Tess Duray and Anselm Kiefer for the Royal Academy, as well as writing the essay for this year's summer exhibition Illustrated Catalogue. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Conrad Shawcross and Richard Davey.
Thank you, Amy. It's a real pleasure to be here interviewing Conrad. I was asked to meet and interview Conrad about two months ago, when asked to do the summer exhibition, and came across his work and talked about his work, The Dappled Light of the Sun. Through that conversation, other avenues and areas of interest emerged. So the conversation this evening is one which, in a sense, is there to unpack and explore and further develop some of those ideas which started to emerge with the original conversation. But first of all, many congratulations about the amazing Dappled Light of the Sun out in the courtyard, which I think can't fail to have an impact on those who come to it. And as well as that, there's a show at Victoria Mirror at the moment. There's your works still in Dulwich Park and also at Roche Court in Wiltshire. So there's a lot of your work around, which is wonderful, so people can get a sense of what you're trying to do. Can I begin with Dappled Light of the Sun?
Yeah, and definitely.
What I want to begin with are these, which it looks fairly mad at the moment, but that's Newark, which is near me up in Nottingham, but tetrahedrons. Tell me about tetrahedrons.
Well, they're essentially the rule of this piece, the sort of dogma of this piece, is that it's entirely composed of tetrahedrons. There are about five sizes of tetrahedrons, so they all nest inside each other. There's about 24,000 triangles, which make up around 8,000 tetrahedrons in the piece. And all of the tetrahedrons, it's very efficient because they all nest inside each other. But they're sort of, so they all, they're like a Russian dolls inside one inside the other. So those are some of the sort of a sketch of the thing, and then there's a truncated one which allows and the mating of a smaller tet onto the larger one. So I wanted to choose a brick, and I've been thinking about the tetrahedron for years, maybe 12 years or something, involved in it as an idea, conceptually and geometrically, and I suppose the starting point was to try and find a brick in which you were going to start to build a structure, a sort of a cellular repeating structure. And unlike a Solowit or a Carl Andre, who chose a literal brick, or the Solowit chose a sort of cube, it's a way of repeating a form and growing something using a rule and a sort of constraint. And I was really attracted to the tetrahedron because it's the simplest of the Platonic solids. So it's this on its own. I have one in my bag here that I thought I'd, but I just this is. This is one of the sort of the seed, if you like. This is actually made of this, the offcut in the center of the center of all these concentric triangles is this solid piece that remains, and so it's the piece that anyway we welded up a few that like this. It's this, but this is kind of like the seed, if you like, of the whole thing, and it's such a rational. It's essentially a three-sided pyramid. When people ask me what is a tetrahedron, and I don't have one to hand, you can describe it. You can describe it as a three-sided pyramid, essentially. So instead of a square base, it has... And it's such a symbol of order and rationale and symmetry and just...
Is it rationale? Because it's basically perverse and that it doesn't
work. So I'll get on to that. So, but on its own, it feels like this this
rational
sort of
thing.
Ordered, yeah. Rational thing. You put it on the table and it just feels, I don't know, it just... But the minute you start putting them together, then the real problems start.
Yeah.
Because it is this irrational, non-repeating form that basically the geometry is such that it basically never... It doesn't tessellate with itself. So a brick or spoons in a drawer will tessellate, and that's why bricks are used in buildings,
yeah.
Is because they work and they fit together. Whereas this has never been used in a building before because
it
doesn't work, and it's very beguiling and it's irrational. And there is one, and then over the years we've sort of discovered different properties, but there is one rule where it forms this triple helix if you put them together, which is sort of the real sort of... It's the crux of a lot of these larger works I've made recently, and it's been a sort of really interesting phenomenon that we've been exploiting a lot. But one of the problems, so with the tetrahedron, what happens is if you start adding a tet to the sides, you can grow out in each direction, and then you can add another set. So you add 4, and then you add 12, and then you keep going. And the rule is you basically can't hit yourself, so you've got to keep growing outwards, bifurcating and bifurcating, and moving out towards, sort of in a radiant way. So it's unlike a... It's essentially this sort of expansionist form. And we were looking at many different sort of structures for kind of guidance in this. We really weren't wanting to make a literal tree or something that was too representational or too easy to define. So I hope, and I purposefully use different nouns to describe it.
Yep.
So I describe it as clouds, as trees, as we've looked at neural pathways in the brain. We looked at lots of crystalline forms and structures like ice and things, but they're not really appropriate because they form a kind of like a fabric. They're strong structural materials. They form these sort of basic like a sheet of woven sort of molecules or the connections. They form a very tight bond, whereas this one... is structurally, and I don't know, is Pete here? Is he here yet? Oh, here he is, there he is. So Pete is my my very loyal exhausted engineer. So he has a company called Structure Workshop. And so this is one of the problems with it is it's structurally, you start and you can't then rely on anything but where you started from. So it's these branches. So it's very similar to a tree, and it has obviously huge echoes with natural forms.
I think that's what really interests me, because on one level, it's metal. It's like a big boy's kind of heavy kind of, just to show you a picture, it's kind of, it involves welding and it involves fire and sparks and kind of macho kind of image. And that comes across in some ways with that, with the work, and with quite a lot of your work. It feels quite macho. It has that kind of sense of solidity, and it has its metal and soldering and so on. Not to say that those are necessarily male attributes, but it has that kind of quality.
I think one of the things with this is that we've been considering this piece for years, Pete and I and my studio, and it's been a piece that's evolved into many different incarnations. And one of the problems with it is the sheer number of parts just was a sort of insurmountable task. And we've looked at different ways of making it out of aluminium extrusion and out of stainless steel, and different ways of trying to reduce the sheer amount of work. And this, I think, is the quickest way to make it, but there is still 12 man years of welding in this piece. I mean, so one person would have taken them 12 years to make it.
It's mad.
It would have
perverse.
Been a heartbreaking job. but luckily, that can quickly change. If you've got 12 people, you can sort of quickly concertina that time.
So you've got all these qualities, and it's manners, and it's work, and so on. But as you hinted, and this is what really fascinates me about the work, you then put it together, and something else takes place. So you start to see these angles, these triangles, become curves in the shadows, and up above there's like a helix. You get curves there which match the clouds, and you get these areas here of curves, and like a tree, like leaves on a tree in the shadows. And suddenly it moves from being metal and man-made and manufactured and engineering and all that you need to think about in putting together these octets and how they might work into something very different. It becomes organic. And what I love is this drawing here. And it reminds me of a fern frond unfolding, mm-hmm. and a sense of something all like an animal claw. It moves from the mechanical into the organic and the natural.
And I think there is some really sort of profound geometry in here, which is, of course, it sort of seems very fundamental to a lot of these sort of natural occurring things. And this sort of drawing or the claw that we refer to it as is this. I mean, it's very sort of like a Robert Smithson or something. It's got there's a sort of very beautiful sort of fractal nature to it.
Absolutely.
And we've really tried to. And the stuff that's been really painstaking, we made many, many prototypes, which basically the decay rate. So with Pete again, Pete helps me with the engineering, the sort of mind-numbing kind of irrational stuff where it's sort of trying to get these branches to work and have to consider whether a van road reverses into it, all these sort of terrible sort of things. And how do you quantify these sort of forces?
Yeah.
But anyway, aside from that, we do these sort of painstaking kind of studies of proportion, not only the proportion of the length of it to the width, to the thickness, but also the rate at which it decays, so how big this one is to this one, to this one, to this one, to this one. So all of the things, we made sort of dozens of studies and prototypes to get to the exact sweet spot of what works, because one of these things, you get one of these off, it just doesn't have it loses all of its power.
And that's what I love, is that people may not see your work initially as something other than, as I said, kind of very engineered and structured, and yet it feels right, and it's what takes over when, in a sense, the art and the visual takes over.
And another nice, really nice thing is that you can't know that on the computer, because when you make something, it's a little bit like the Albertian facade. The Albertian facade isn't, it looks square, but actually it's not.
Absolutely.
And there is distortion, which has been put in because the eye, even though it's an incredible instrument, it creates an illusion that it's small at the top unless you make it bigger at the top.
Mm.
And even your eye compensates, but it's still, in order to make something look right, you've got to make it wrong. And with these, the relationship of proportion isn't linear. It's not what you would expect it to be. So when we did the first sort of stuff, we make a linear relation of length to width to height to all that thing, it cascades normally. It didn't look right. So we just fudged it in the end to make the eye look right to the eye. So
absolutely.
It's a sort of interesting kind of compensation that you make that isn't actually rational or logical.
It reminds me of an artist who's based in Northumbria and who's been in the summer exhibition before, called James Huguenin, who does these mad grids. It takes him a year to paint these paintings, which are grids of silver point grids with then a colour in each. And like you, numbers for each telling you what colour's going where and the way it works. And it's precise until the end when it doesn't quite work and he has to fudge it. And that's when you get these ripples like sand, kind of wind-blown sand on the beach where water's kept in the hollows and so on. And it's that same feel here of you put the process in, but it doesn't quite work at the end, and what you get is the organic. And that seems to me at the very heart of your work is this balance between the mechanical and design and the organic and unplanned and the two held in tension, as it were.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, I'm glad there is. I mean, it's one of the dangers with this problem. I think one of the things that's helped also by the materials and this declared world down the edge is that a lot of the other way of doing it, making it in, riveting it together in lots of sort of laser cut components or something, or using an extrusion with a chamfer, it was going to become too cold and too designy. And I think one of the things, though, even though it is very designed, is the materiality and the handmadeness of the material really,
really important,
takes it out,
get
away from that again. And I think the other thing is that the piece, even though we've been working on it for many years, it was very much, I asked the Royal Academy for the opportunity to propose an idea. And this one, as opposed to a sort of totemic object placed in the courtyard, was the thing that I was most intrigued about trying to make work. Yeah. And the materials in relation to the buildings was incredibly important, that it had this quite earthy, against the earthy sort of gritty sort of feel against the Portland stone. But also, in some ways, and we can come on to it later, but it's the classical environment that allows this thing to breathe, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's the contrast to the man-made, because it doesn't. Even though it is very man-made, it feels incredibly natural.
And you get that. I love this drawing where you've got the process, and then you have the circles, and it's like looking at a tree or flowers or leaves or it's a spiral, organic spiral at the top, and that can often be forgotten, or people think immediately metal. Soldering and don't look at the organic nature.
This is a drawing that I did with Pete. I've actually drawn over one of Pete's beautiful models here, which is just to sort of sketch the ideas. But this is the sort of one of the first sort of see it in plan.
Yeah.
And you get this sort of crystal. So it's actually a 3D drawing that's just taken from plan, but you get this really crystalline sort of feel to it. I mean, it could be a sort of a crystal, or it could be hopefully it zings between many different interpretations of what it could be. And the exciting thing is that there's so, or slightly daunting as well, there's so many different rules in which how you can grow it. And we're just sort of tip of the iceberg in terms of this new system, all the variables and some, I mean, it's really, because this one actually grows out in more of, in quite a horizontal plane, and it grows upwards like a plant looking for the light. But you could make a completely radiant one, which wouldn't need the... but this has got this almost like the flat level underneath it where the tripods... So it's like a cloud, a sort of nimbus. So underneath it's flat, and on the top it's sort of more voluminous and sort of...
So it's cloud, it's trees. And as a sculptor, you have to go underneath it, and then your view is totally changed. And you see this thing almost walking towards you and kind of... engaging with you, as you say.
And this was one of the sort of starting points, was this idea that we've all, that is sort of a universal experience of sitting underneath a tree in the summer and the sounds and the light, the dappled light of the sun. And I don't know, the phrase came very quick early on in the project a few months ago, and it was one of those sort of titles that usually you struggle for a title in a way for get it to not sort of do something like, I mean, it'd be called like Tetra Cloud or something like that, something terrible, sort of, which would be the normal sort of title, and it'd be fine, but it would just be a bit kind of macho and a bit sort of boring. But this one where it refers to the effect that it has I'm really pleased with it as a.
And what's really important for me is when you see the work in place, is that interrelationship between the physical work and the shadows. And it becomes almost the shadows are part of the work itself and give it that kind of, again, they're not always there because depending on what the light's like and the sun and so on, and they weren't really there.
I think one of the things also, the shadows are almost more readable than the form itself.
Yeah.
And that's what, the shadows aren't two-dimensional, they're three-dimensional, but they're almost like, they show this much more clearly, and you get a sense of the object
absolutely
more clearly than you do from the object itself.
Yeah.
So there's something. One of the things that I suppose that I like about the idea of this inference of a shadow and the shadow referring to an object is this. I made this piece called Slow Arc Inside a Cube, which was it's a light that moves very slowly from one side of a cube to another, and it creates this inverted shadow of a cube in a room. But it was inspired by this quotation from Dorothy Hodgkin, who was a scientist working in the last century, and she pioneered a process called crystal radiography, in which she worked out the protein, this kind of protein cloud of pig insulin, and it was this incredibly complex protein cloud. Mm. But she was essentially, in very layman's terms, essentially like shining light through crystals and seeing the shadows on the wall of what they create. But she described the process as like trying to work out the structure of a tree by only seeing its shadow, which is kind of quite a lovely Plato's cave analogy, but it's also very humble.
Yeah.
Very humble. It's like we all sat under that tree, so it's very accessible, but it also just implies that you're never going to work out that tree. You might glimpse parts of it, but it's through a glass darkly. It's a humble quote, a sort of phrase that you'll never be able to understand all the bark and all the twigs and all the ants. Yeah. all the intracosm is on that tree. But we'll get close, but not really ever.
And I want to come to that later, because I think that is a fundamental part of your work, that sense of formlessness. They're moving a sense from that sense of the trees. Suddenly, this work, which is the work in Dulwich Park, which is still there?
Yeah, they're there forever.
They're still there forever. Yeah. Replacing a Barbara Hepworth sculpture. What fascinates me, as well as these actually really relate to the trees and the organic and natural, is another element of your work, which again is both very visible and fundamental to your work, but also often highly overlooked, and that's the space, that's the whole, mm-hmm. which the solid material of the work mm-hmm. contains. Mm-hmm. What is it about space and that whole which fascinates you?
Well, I mean, I suppose this piece, I mean, there's obviously a link that should be mentioned to, obviously, to Hepworth and her sort of lifelong investigation, preoccupation with the whole, and I did want to have a subtle nod to her piece. And I suppose one of the first things, when I was doing research into the work and how I was going to respond to not only the part, but also to this legacy of this difficult thing to potentially replace a piece of such sort of fame and respect. But I think it's one of the things, I remember seeing a photo of a kid in looking through, just sort of climbing through the hole of the Hepworth. And it was quite a small work. It was quite a formal work. It was on a plinth, and it was a... But apparently the kids, and I watched the kids in the park, and it doesn't have a lot of sort of children's infrastructure in the park. No. There's some great, they have these rented bikes and things, but there's not, it's a bit impoverished for things for kids to do, but they were just, even a little lamppost, the kids would just run around this lamppost and just make play out of the most simple, limited things. And it was just, and I suppose in terms of creating a hole or a space in which you enter, and I wanted to really create the opposite of a civic sculpture, but one that would invite tactility and play, and I've got slightly more than I bargained for, because literally, I mean, this is quite an extreme moment in that there's only one kid on this thing.
Yeah.
But there's usually about between 20 and 30 children on each, on all of, on, well, between them, on about 10 on each. So sort of they become incredibly climbable things, which are being really used, which is fantastic. And I wanted that to happen. I just didn't expect it to be quite as extreme as it is. But it's great.
So, as you say, there's not much in Dulwich Park. What really interests me, and it's going in a different direction, but I think is there in your work, and in a sense we see it here, but in a sense it's hinted at here because they're based on music, is that that hole feels like a space, it feels like a gap, an empty, but in effect it's solid. It's solid with atoms, and going back to the tetrahedron, the tetrahedron was the symbol for the atom in Greek thinking. And music travels because the space between us isn't empty, but has atoms and photons and molecules which vibrate and are points of connection. And so these holes, this space, contains not emptiness, but actual matter. It's a solid but almost intangible, and that seems to come through with that music, the references to music.
Yeah, and these first pieces were created using light originally, so these forms were originally I don't know if any of you have been to down Dulwich Picture Gallery, but like it came down on Sunday, but in the mausoleum there was this very fast spinning light piece called Counterpoint. And that was a 5-4 ratio, and this one's a 4-3 ratio, and this one's a 4-3, and this one's a 3-2, and this one's a 2-1.
But can you explain what you mean by that?
So they're basically these they're descriptions of chords or drones, so perpetual chords. They're called three perpetual chords. But about 15 years ago, I was really interested in. I'd been reading about string theory, and so I was. And I'm not an academic, really. I glean a lot of ideas, and I remember reading about string theory, and I was reading about harmonics, and I sort of had this idea that, okay, a particle isn't a particle, it's a loop. And so I was thinking about that, and so I created a very kind of rickety wooden machine in my bedroom, and and it was a 2-to-1 ratio on the end. So it was an in music, that's the octave. So it's basically playing a middle C and then the C above it. So you get double the it's a 2-to-1 ratio of their frequencies.
Yep.
Whereas and then the fifth is a 3-to-2. So it's the amalgamation of two sine waves of different frequencies to form one noisy sine wave. That's a sort of which our brain for some reason finds very pleasing. And when you represent, so what I was trying to do is represent that thing visually. But I had a wonderful eureka moment where I turned on this machine with this light bulb flicking around really fast, and I took a photograph of it, and it looked like a mental machine that didn't look like, I mean, it was just looked crazy and quite scary.
Yeah.
But when you took a photograph of it, you got this beautiful sort of Pringle-like bent form, which is this one here. But it was this sort of wonderful moment where I felt like a scientist discovering this form, and they're actually in mass, they're called toroidal knots.
And so in a sense, what you've got here is not just in the space contained here, a kind of container for space, a reminder of emptiness, but actually in the form itself, you've got a visualization of those kind of atoms, of photons, of things moving through the empty space between us and between every solid object, and actually dancing through the space. And so what feels empty is actually full of this movement and dance and, again, this energy.
Yeah.
And so your work has that kind of energy contained within it.
And I think one of the things, when we did some early tests on this, we made it in... the loop was the same diameter as it goes around.
Yeah.
And one of the things here that gives it the energy is that as it goes around, it gets thinner here, and it comes around, it gets fatter here, and it's really fat there, and it's really thin here. And this diameter of the sausage is welded in these sort of essentially these sausages that go around is analogous to how fast the light bulb was rotating when we took a photograph. So like a paintbrush, when you take a photograph of a fast light bulb, it's thin, and when it's slower, it's fatter because it's burning into the photograph.
And that in a sense relates to color because
and painting or just however fast you paint a brush to it fast, it's thin, slow, it's fatter. And again, Pete's sort of very structure workshop has sort of really painstakingly we worked out an equation to create that, turn that light bulb into a relationship to thickness and sort of create these forms. And then all the castings, it's quite laborious because it means all the castings are different, but it's really worth it.
Coming back to the dappled light, I think there is that relationship between those works in Dulwich and here where, again, we look at it as being, as you say at times, quite solid down the bottom. But it actually, there are moments when you see blue and white and grey contained within those triangles. I described it in the catalogue for the summer exhibition as being like a James Turrell sky piece, where you look up and you're forced to look at something which actually is quite empty. It's back to the holes and to formlessness and nothingness again, where you see something and are forced to look at it and concentrate on that, and it holds it and it becomes precious, as it were, for that moment. And I love that you've got it within the individual triangles, and then the whole piece just seems to hold the sky and pull it down towards us. So it's not just a solid object, but it's making what air become solid.
And I think the other thing that's really nice is that these tripods that hold it up are very they're very minimal, and they're very sort of that they have incredibly slender ankles. But as a result of that, instead of, because this thing weighs 25 tons, so it's a massive piece. And when it was on the ground, I was worried about it. I mean, it looked very aggressive. It looked like a sort of anti-tank trap.
Yeah.
And I was getting a lot of, because I was there in my hard hat, and I was getting a lot of comments from some more conservative people in coming to Royal Academy saying, what the hell is this monstrosity? Who allowed this thing to be in the courtyard? And I was a bit worried myself because it was taking up so much space. But the minute we put them up, it is this ascendant sort of thing.
And what they're held on, those tripods are tetrahedrons, aren't they?
Yeah.
So the whole thing is this kind of atomic. Absolutely.
But due to the sort of, and I use the word audacious because it sort of winds Pete up a bit, but Pete's audacious engineering, again, with these very slender these very slender ankles, and we were sort of joking, but slightly worried as well, because when we were putting them on, they are very thin, Pete. And we were, but they, and it was a beautiful moment, because you just put them down, and they've got these universal joints at the top, and they
just sit
down,
into
they just
it.
Sit, they sort of locate themselves, and it was just very nice. But they give, because they're so light and they're tapered, and we've got the, we have a very creative partnership, which we've gone on for 10 years. So it's just, but we just know each other's the aesthetic that we want and what I want and how to get it, achieve what we need. But they just, they almost feel like they're tying them down rather than holding them up. I hope.
So like this, balloons, like
they're almost,
the string,
yeah, they're like
yeah,
tethers,
string on tethers,
they're tethers rather than legs.
That sense of a helium balloon full of gas, invisible gas.
Yeah.
What I found fascinating then was the show from Roche Court, going back to that way of thinking, where you have the tetrahedrons, you've got a development, a kind of variation on the dappled light and these tetrahedron works, and then you've got these blue, are they perspex or glass?
It's actually stained glass.
Stained glass.
They're hand-rolled glass in there, so it's...
And so suddenly, it's like looking, yeah, there's the sky contained, that piece of blue sky contained within the tetrahedron that we see down there in the courtyard is the same thing here. This kind of containing the sky, but also containing colour and containing photons of light and atoms. It's that sense of containment.
Yeah, I mean, these ones are, again, they're based on sort of ancient geometries, radiant geometries. They have this sort of centre which you can sort of deduct or infer from the faces, but they're called plosions, so as in explosion or implosion.
Yeah.
So they could be expansion or contraction, and they are but they again using these constraints of these rules of very specific platonic geometry. I mean, these are really painstaking to make because we sort of build up the edge again and again until we get this very sharp edge. So they're very labour intensive. But these, I suppose, they're in a way they I'd like to make those. So the reason I've started to put the glass in is just to play around with this idea of them being these internal spaces. So they actually, the idea is to make them big enough to be enterable in.
Yeah.
So again, on this sort of scale of it being a canopy or a pavilion, it's this sort of, it's taking it to that architectural scale.
And we're back to space in these works, which are at Victoria Mirror at the moment?
That's right, yeah.
Which are inverted spires, and these big, open, empty containers for space, these holes, a bit like the Barbara Hepworth and the work in Dulwich. Mm-hmm. And then we get these works, which really fascinate me, where you've got the solid facet and the gap, in a sense, between. So you have space still there, but you're moving into the solid face, which is the final generation of the tetrahedron in Dappled Light of the Sun, where it's not an open tetrahedron, it's a solid one. Mm-hmm. And then you have this work, which does something very different. What is it about the solid compared to the open?
I think that, I'm really pleased with this room and the way that it feels, and it was a lovely opportunity to create all this array of work, because I really enjoy making a sequence and using a sequence to sort of basically a little bit like musical notes in a score or words in a dictionary. They by creating the contrast or the control, they define themselves more brilliantly. All of these works, apart from this one and this one, they're the inverted spires, and then all around a piece I'm doing in King's Cross, which is this one here, and this is going to be a 14 meter high sculpture outside of the Francis Crick Institute in October or November, and it's a big biomedical lab that's opening, and it's a very exciting building for London. There's 1,200 scientists working in it, it's called Paradigm, and it's essentially a stack of tetroids, of sort of slightly warped tetrahedrons that get slightly bigger each time. And these are structural versions of it. But they're all these different things where they have different growth factors. And again, we've looked at different ways of growing them. This is these new ones, which you've referred to as this one and this one, are these they're called paradigm chamfer, but they have these extreme exploded chamfers where the edge, like these welded edges on the thing, get amplified to be as big as the face themselves. Right. So they're sort of becoming these much more crystalline stacks, and they're even more precarious. But essentially, they're epistemological actualized metaphors, if you like. They look at the idea of the building this idea of building one's argument on certain foundations, and the sort of Tower of Babel, or the idea of an argument, or the tree of where you grow, you have an assumption of certainty, and then you build your argument upwards from that point, the Tower of Knowledge.
What I find fascinating, just there are two things from these which really interest me. One is just a hint at the notion of DNA and the helix and that kind of the sequence, the DNA, genome sequence, and that sense of life. And so they look very kind of metallic objects, and yet they're about life. And this one, these two, which are, as you say, not quite part of the series, are really dancing, seem to be like, atoms dancing, photons dancing around the centre of the nucleus in an atom. But what interests me and is this kind of question with these works. Are they inverted spars? Are they coming, trying to come down to a single point of knowledge, that kind of notion of the answer to everything, that kind of, the Douglas Adams 42? Are you trying to find 42? Or is it a postmodern way of looking, of saying, actually, coming from the modernist project of there was a single answer to knowledge, actually saying, no, there are diverse facets, and we need to see individual subjective facets as equally relevant, and rather than being this dogmatic single point of knowledge which goes back as well into religious forms of knowledge or scientific forms of knowledge, actually... Mm-hmm. These seem to hover between the two. Is this between single knowledge and multiple knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's something quite contradictory about these works in terms of this idea of time or the linearity of time. Because I still see them as basically stacks in which you start and you grow upwards. Time is essentially they're going bigger as they go up. But the manifolds, time is, I see them as time moving downwards. But with the piece outside, so as these ones, time is sort of going this way with these ones, and they're getting bigger. But the problem with the ones in the courtyard is that these ones are radiantly travelling outwards, and the smaller ones are the youngest, and the middle are the oldest. But and that makes sense in terms of the way that we see trees. These don't follow a sort of a natural growth pattern where, essentially, these would, as they grow up, they would be small at the top. The radical would be at the top.
Yeah.
So you'd sort of flip it, and I think. But the reason I like this is because it creates this sense of precariousness, and this sense of progress, but yet fallibility. So the reason it's called paradigms is the idea that if you added another tet of knowledge to the top, the whole thing may just collapse.
And what I love is that it's called linear time, wrapped around by a corkscrewing
the triple
time.
Helix. There's a triple helix. It's like an alien DNA.
Absolutely.
The one thing, ironically, I mean, funnily enough, the one thing they said when they were doing the competition, they said, we don't want a sculpture of DNA. And so the triple helix was not something that I was purposefully promoting as a thing, saying this is a better form of DNA than it's got another helix, not just two, it's got three. But that one there is, if you go
so
back
that's
one,
the,
so you go back sorry. One, sorry, the that one, this is the one for King's Cross. So, but the this is it's going to be very, again, it's been a lovely project working with Pete on it, because it's very, very thin here. It's only like a meter and a half, and then it's 14 meters tall, so you'll be sort of this big on the thing. So it's a huge thing. And it's like the top piece is like the size of a double-decker bus. So it's, audacious engineering. And the piles, the foundations of it go like 30 metres into the air.
And what I love is the curve which goes down that edge there.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got this sense of up and down and this sense of growth and the trees again. And the sense of growth which we see out there with the dappled light of the sun, this sense of outer growth and the dance, I would say, this movement of these. And then we come to this work, which was Sudley Castle.
Yeah.
How many years ago?
This is maybe nearly 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
And this is the sort of starting point of it all. And it was, I regard this sculpture as a failure, but it's probably one of the most important works that I've made, in that I've sort of learned so much from it. And it was an extremely naive, sort of kind of foolhardy, sort of bold and stupid sort of a decision of mine, yeah, to basically make 1,000 tetrahedrons made of wood, but not knowing anything about the tetrahedron. I was literally, as I hadn't made a cardboard few and tried to put them together, I literally thought they would, I didn't, I thought,
so how many man hours
laid together? I just hadn't even done any research. It was just completely bold, like, yeah, sort of audacious thing to do. And then I turned up at Sudley and say, I'm just going to arrive there and I'm going to make a sculpture out of all these pieces. And I didn't know what it was going to look like. I didn't do any modelling. I didn't do any. I had no idea what I was going to do. But I was completely flummoxed by this lively, chaotic, sort of irrational thing that just, it sort of almost built itself. And I was there. And then the other problem was that it was in this ancient garden. It was made of wood and it was next to these amazing trees. And it was just looking like a bad version of the bush behind, or the, it was just really, the context was wrong, and then but I was completely bamboozled by it, and it's been something I've since then been thinking about. And the other thing is that it still has this radiant property where you've got to grow out from the middle, and this one is sort of growing up and around. It forms this sort of tetris. I can't remember what it's called, some macho tetrasphere or something. I don't know. It doesn't have the same poetic name. But this one's really interesting in that you've got this, there is this radiant thing which sort of implies entropy or time, yeah, or so the universe expanding, or this just growth. It just implies a center and things moving out from there. But because the tets are all the same size, there is also this lack of hierarchy between them. So yeah, there's a disconnect with this idea of it growing and then with them also remaining the same size. So I think what the lovely thing about the courtyard is that as it goes out, they get smaller, and there is this sense of it describes time.
I think why we wanted to show this is because, for me, in a sense, shows you letting go as you've learned. And this is a bit like going back to what I said about, it's not letting it grow, it's like the topiary. The topiary looks beautiful, but actually it's very artificial. It's not natural growth, it's ordered, kind of cut and contained and held, just like this sculpture. And so for me it fails, well, no, I think it's a beautiful piece, but it fails on two levels. One, because it's wood and sitting in the garden, and does it quite work? Is it too illustrative? But the other is because it feels contained. It doesn't have that growth. It has that kind of, it feels too held down, and that sense of organic freedom and kind of, I don't know where it's going, is not as visible here. It seems to be, here is a mound of tets. Look what I've constructed. And you don't get that sense of, where's it going? I'm not in control anymore, as you say. And I think it's a beautiful, fascinating piece. And fascinating because it highlights actually the importance in your work of the kind of growth, of the organic nature of it, of that sense of not knowing and irresolution, which is inherent in working with tets, that you kind of start and you let go, and it kind of goes not quite where you control it by saying, right, it's stopping here. But it's that implication of it goes beyond the frame, as it were. Whereas here it seems contained. It doesn't seem that there's any life going out beyond the frame. As I said, there's this sense of hover between going out and coming in. That kind of, they almost seem to breathe, that kind of, are they expanding or are they contracting? It's as though they're just, you know, despite being incredibly solid and stable, particularly the one in the middle, has that sense of, it's like a freeze frame from a film of an explosion, but it's that moment where it could be a reversed explosion coming back.
Yeah, and I think there's pieces like Lattice Cube Sequence, which again is these sort of they're like four cubes and they basically expand outwards, and they're made of four-sided shapes. Each cube is made of 48 tetroids, but I sort of see them as almost like a Muybridge photograph of an explosion or of a man running. It's like their sculptures caught in a moment, but by them being in a sequence, you feel like they are like photographs of a moment in time, an instance. And so these pieces, I mean, piece, I wanted to put it in because the show was all made of this weathered steel and bronze, and it's all quite heavy, and I wanted to have this similar form, but just exploded as this very light. It's made of 100% sort of mirrored stainless steel, so it sort of loses the surface. It doesn't really have a surface, so it mimics its surroundings.
And it feels, in a sense, like creation. It feels like an Anselm Kiefer work of this kind of explosion out from abstract nothingness into a solid form. But that solid form is dissolving because beneath the paintings are all the flakes of the paint which are falling off the painting as they return into atoms. And you get the same with this sense of kind of the solid form exploding, returning to atoms, but also at the same time holding and preparing to return back to a solid form. That circularity, which is fascinating. What I want to come to now is the madness of the work, as it were, for me. It's the kind of, all of them seem to be, even the spires, which are fairly contained, are about the however many hundreds of man hours and the number, the 8,000 tets, that they almost become formless. There's too much to see. That they almost become like an image of the sublime, the kind of the 18th century, that they are awful in the sense of they inspire awe because you can't see it. As you said earlier on, you can't see it from a single position. You're left always seeing through a glass darkly, you're always left looking at this thing which somehow feels untouchable, as it were. And that's what I find fascinating about The Dappled Life of the Sun, this sense of however much you might think you understand it, you never will, and get the full impact.
Yeah, I mean, it is incredibly beguiling, and I think, I mean, we should probably get Pete to talk about it, because he's at the coalface of a lot of this stuff. So I don't know if, Pete, you want to say a bit about madness and things.
The danger of talking to me is that you get just a sort of technical, much drier sense of it.
But I think it's good for you to say them, because it's one thing for me to sort of, I have these sort of ideas, and I think I'm very immersed in it, in the technique of it all, but the amount of man hours of the logistics around getting this from just an idea to
it's interesting
result.
Hearing you talk about it as macho. Sort of privately, I think of it as quite gothic, not in a sort of atmospheric sense, but in that the architecture and the structure are sort of symbiotic.
Yeah,
you know, they go together. And so, if you look at a gothic cathedral, it has this beauty and this sort of this wonder. But if you look at it closer, it's got this incredibly rational structure, so that the statues are placed on top of the buttresses to give counterbalances to move the forces sweetly down into the foundations. And do you see what I mean?
And the Gothic cathedral is actually a really good way of seeing these works, because the Gothic cathedral, whilst the architects had some knowledge, a large element of the way they were built was, let's just push it and hope that it will work and stand up there. And the number of cathedrals whose spires slowly gave way or even fell down, because they didn't quite work on the engineering principles, demonstrates. And it's that kind of, we need flying buttresses because actually without them, they're not going to work. It wasn't an engineering solution. It was that physical solution of, we need to keep these things up. And I think that's fascinating. One question for you before moving on. When you're confronted with 8,000 tetrahedrons or kind of all this soldering, and you and the others manufacturing, are faced with this, do you find yourself becoming lost in that process of manufacturing? Because it's a minimalist, it's almost a repetitive process of doing a very similar thing, you know, for long periods of time. And does it become...
Well, I mean, it's important to say I'm not manufacturing
it. No.
And that sort of, you know, there's also some really skilled craftsmen who are, you know, incredible at welding.
Absolutely.
And have the sort of the infrastructure to take on a project like this. But, I mean, interesting, with Dapper Light and the Sun, because of the program, we started cutting the tetrahedra before the design had been resolved. So, excuse me. And so we're constantly trying to catch up or keep up with the process. And so from an engineering point of view, the big issue is defining the problem. So when you're talking about the fact that you can't actually... encompass it visually and understand the piece. You know, that is our problem, to understand the piece or to define the piece so that we can then, you know, as an engineer, what we want to do is model it, analyze it, look at the forces. And even though there's this incredible repeat and decay and repetition within it, there are actually locations in it that have particularly high stress that are critical.
Right.
And that's what we're looking for. So we want to define the piece, model it, analyze it, apply loads to it, wind loads. Perhaps someone's going to climb it, and then which is the critical bolt, and is it big enough?
And that goes back to what we've been teasing out is this kind of this balance between the rational and the irrational, the mechanical and the organic. And for me, there's something in these last series. Photographs about the kind of the sublime and the beautiful that which in philosophical terms you can't put together, but actually in this work I think somehow seems to this kind of the sublime formlessness, the sense of you can't contain it, you can't kind of capture it, is this through a glass darkly, and yet what's incredibly important to you is that each edge, each individual face has the same amount of attention detail, that actually the work is both sublime and yet it's about that beautiful, beautifully constructed single face as well.
I think that one of the things that's really led up, we've got this declared weld along the edge, because these ones have this sharp edge, so the points come together and you get this, so these ones have this chamfer, which actually creates a very nice confluence of four tets when they form this sort of nodal confluence. Confluence,
yeah.
Confluence. It's funny to hear Pete say that we ordered, because basically I did exactly the same as I did in Sudley Castle. Really.
Yes.
I ordered 8,000 tetrahedrons before we knew how we were going to make it, how we were going to put it together, if it was going to work structurally. It's still sort of bold and stupid, but it's sort of, I guess...
And it's that kind of, it's starting a drawing, isn't it? That this is like, these are drawings. They may seem to be big designed and engineered structures, but actually it's like, as we've seen with the drawings on paper, they are drawings in the air with metal. You know, kind of not a pencil, but you've got these metal lines which become your way of drawing in the air. And what I love is that edge there. And you know, if you haven't looked closely at the work, that edge, to me, is where this work, and I think all your work, it kind of contains what your work is about. It's that meeting. It's a really interesting place of meeting between the organic and
the physical. But they also have to be cellular. They have to be independent, because there's another way of making this where you just make the skin, and they're not autonomous cells that stacked. And we had the same problem with King's Cross. We were looking at other ways of making it with a sort of frame inside.
Can you unpack what do you mean for the non-engineer?
So they all bolt together.
Right.
So they have mating faces,
yeah,
and they bolt together, and they all can come apart into autonomous cells or pieces. So they're not. You could in a way join two of these tetrahedrons together, and then no one would know that the internal plate is there. So you share a plate, share a face.
I see.
But they don't share any faces. They are all autonomous bricks in their own right, or cells or units. So it's about this idea of
And this takes us back to the atom again, that an atom is an individual, that individual element of the universe, which then kind of combines with other atoms to form objects which are more complex and more fascinating and more beautiful and unique. And this is what this work, in a sense, is about, is this movement from the individual atom to, in a sense, the coagulated object, which is this unfolding, amazing cloud, tree, crystalline work of art, as it were, and a space, as it were, to sit and look and see holes in space, to see the sky as coming down and almost touchable, and to see those individual elements. And I think in that way, it completely belies the materials. And yet it's dependent. Those materials are weathering themselves. They are themselves atomic. You know, they're affected and changing and developing and growing.
Yeah, no, it's quite autumnal now. Which is, sort of they're turning orange, and sort of it's got definitely a sort of, and it's nice just coming back each week and seeing it different.
That change,
yeah.
And it changes with the sky. It changes with the sun. It changes with whether you walk underneath it, walk around it, walk, you know, one way around it, and seeing different elements of it. So I want to leave, in a sense, with that image of this amazing work, which kind of leads us both into the summer exhibition and out of the summer exhibition, which sets a way of approaching the summer exhibition this year as a way of looking, not just as a kind of a huge sculpture, but actually shaping the way we look, shaping us to look at small things, shaping us to look beyond immediate perceptions, to look beyond our kind of preconceptions of what something is, and to allow ourselves to see what it might be. So, Conrad, thank you so much for your time and
for the
conversation.
Thank you for your eloquence. Thank you.
We do have just a couple of minutes if anyone has any questions.
Thank you, Conrad. I think it's completely inspirational. And I'm talking as a maths teacher. And I'm particularly interested to know whether there was any aspect of your school mathematics that led you to ask some of the questions that you now are certainly exploring through your work, ideas of proportion, ideas of similarity, and the journey that you've gone on to produce what are absolutely stunning pieces of work.
Well, I definitely did have I had a math teacher who was very inspiring to me. I was really sad not to have him at A level, but at GCSE, and I did pure one A level with him before I went into my sixth form. But he was a very eccentric mathematician. He was called Mr. Jones Parry, and he was great. But he was quite an anarchic teacher, and he used to smoke roll-ups outside the door while he was drawing on the blackboard. But he just used to talk about ideas, not just about the maths. And he was talk about the shape of the universe and how the fifth dimension would be like being inside a marigold glove. And it was just exciting stuff. And I wasn't ever going to be a great mathematician, and I did it for A level, and I did physics for A level. But I quickly, it was much more about the ideas than all the number crunching. I wasn't ever going to excel at that side of things, in terms of taking it forward as a profession. But there was a good example of that.
I know it's described as being a weathering steel or weathered steel, but it does seem to be weathering faster than I would expect steel to weather. Have you done something to the steel to make it weather?
We haven't actually. Some of it was outside a bit longer than others because we obviously made it in some bits were left outside for longer up north in Newark. It's copper impregnated steel, so it will form a rust layer on the outside and then not rust beyond that layer. So it's a structural steel that is designed to go outside, so it won't fall apart. It'll just get more orange. It's I think Yeah, I don't know. It does change quickly. I mean, I think it's a combination of a bit of the showers and then the sun. It's a very quick. It's probably the quickest time of year for it to change in many ways.
It does. I saw it on the first day, and I've seen it a couple of times since. But even just seeing it this evening, it seems to have weathered it just in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, no, it has. I mean, you can accelerate it with sort of acids or lemon juice or Coca-Cola. But I mean, with smaller works, we've done that. But with this, it would be a lot of lemons.
Any more questions?
Does it have a home to go to after it's been here for the summer exhibition?
Well, not yet. No, it's one of the sort of the slightly annoying parts of being an artist is that you can't sort of just sort of put your paint draft down, so to speak, and relax. One of the big problems with big works is to finish the creative process is to find a permanent location or home for it. So, because now it's when it's being used and it justifies itself, and hopefully it's a very it's been very thoughtfully considered as about being quite a civic piece. It's meant to be used and sat underneath and used and enjoyed. It's not a sort of isolated thing that it does have a real sort of social aspect to it, a civic aspect to it in the way that it or architectural aspect, and it will be used and part of the infrastructure of a piazza or a square or a, I mean, I think it even could go inside in a big atrium. In some ways, it would be very stunning in an indoor environment, in a very neutral white space. But now that it's rusted, it could really... I hope it will find a home, because it doesn't actually take up any space, except when it's being delivered on a lorry, when it takes up six juggernauts. But the footprint is very efficient. It will find a permanent location.
Thank you very much for coming tonight, and thank you for your questions. There are signed copies of Conrad's publication, which is called The Dappled Light of the Sun, available in the shop, so do go and ask the staff about that. The exhibition in this space and the two adjoining rooms is by Eileen Cooper. It will stay open until 8:30. The summer exhibition is, of course, open till 10 o'clock tonight. And, of course, Conrad's sculpture is outside. It's not just in slides, so please do go and have a look at it. Hopefully the sun is still shining. But please join me in thanking Conrad and Richard for an excellent talk.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.